Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Now, we are the only radio show where it melts in your mouth and not in your brain. Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by the Unclaimed Forum on Web Sleuths. Anyone can join and help as members work with coroners across the country to try and find unclaimed victims' families. It's very fulfilling, but it is emotional work. Go to websleuths.com/forums and just look for the missing forums. Scroll on down, you'll see it, and you'll find the unclaimed forums, and you can jump on in and help us out. Tonight, our guests are Laurie Thompson. Laurie is Emma Thompson's grandmother. Now, Laurie's son was married to Abigail Young and later divorced. And this is the woman, Abigail Young, that is up for parole after serving less than 2 years of her 20-year sentence for standing by and letting her boyfriend sexually abuse their young Emma to death. Now, the boyfriend got life in prison, and Abigail got 20 years, but why in the world she's up for parole, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We have with us as well Andy Kahn. He is the City of Houston, Texas Crime Victims Assistant Director, and he's got some very interesting things to tell us about some crime bills. Later on, Katie Cool Lady will be here. Yes, she will. And she's going to update us on the drama that we know as Jodi Arias. What has she done now? There are rumors flying that she got in a big fight with her lawyers, that she had a breakdown. I mean, all kinds of things. Why was the sentencing phase postponed until Wednesday, no less? I'm hoping Katie has the answers for us, but we'll have to wait and see. But first, it's Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all of you wonderful mothers. Now, you can be a mother whether you gave birth to a child or not. There's lots of kids out there that need loving, and I know lots of women out there and men who act as mothers and fathers. So happy Mother's Day to you. Now, we know Mother's Day as the one that was established by Anna Jarvis. Mother's Day has been around, certain variations of it, for a long time. And the story is that Anna started it in 1907. Now some people call Mother's Day the Hallmark holiday. Now, I'm just going to take a little time here and tell you a bit about my mom. My mom passed away in 1993. She passed away from cancer, and she was a lovely British woman. She looked just like Vivian Leigh. Very elegant lady, drank her tea literally with her pinky sticking out. I'm not making that up. I swear she did. She loved mystery novels, and she was your typical stiff upper lip British woman who survived the bombings of London as a teenager to end up marrying an American, my dad, who was in the Office of Selective Service, which I think now is called the CIA, and this was right after World War II while they were both working in Germany. Now, my mom was not one to get emotional. She was very loving. I had no doubt she loved me, but she just really was truly stiff upper lip type lady, although she did get emotional over a washcloth. I'm not making this up. It's a stupid washcloth. In seventh grade sewing, we had to make something for our mothers for Mother's Day. I picked a thing that a one-handed blind ape could sew, and that was a washcloth. My homemaking skills have never been shining. Yes, probably some of you know, I don't sew at all. Anyway, I make this tacky-looking piece of God knows what type of fabric. I cut it into a square. I put something in the middle, and then I cut another square, and then I hand sew it together. It was just horrible. And that was my beautiful washcloth Mother's Day gift. My poor mom. I can just see her at church that Mother's Day back in the early 70s with her lady friends. They're all in the choir and they're talking about lovely things like, oh, my daughter gave me a wonderful charm bracelet. And my daughter gave me a handmade quilt. And my mom had to say, and my goofy daughter gave me a washcloth. But I'll tell you, she acted like that washcloth was made of gold. She was so proud of it. And she kept it. She kept it forever. And a few years before she died, I was helping her clean out a closet, and I came across this washcloth, and I was just mortified. I'm like, Mom, I am so sorry. And she says, oh, no, no, it's lovely. I'm so glad you found it. And she put it in a place where she could see it forever until she died. You know, that's the type of mother that we hope everybody has, one that loves their daughter enough to make a big deal out of a stupid-looking washcloth. And I was very lucky to have that mother. And I'm sure a lot of you are very lucky to have a wonderful mother as well. But tonight we're going to talk about a monster mother, unfortunately. And that is Abigail young. Please welcome Laurie Thompson to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Laurie's son was married to Abigail Young. They are now divorced. And Laurie, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here this evening to talk with you.
Thank you. And we're going to be talking a little bit later on. Let's see. We're going to get all of this out here. Hold on one second here. My computer just blew up. There we go. Andy Kahn. Andy, welcome. You are the City of Houston's Texas Crime Victims Assistant Director. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You bet.
Okay, and we're going to talk with Laurie first, and then Andy will get to you. Laurie, you are Emma's grandmother. And why don't you tell us, first of all, your son became involved with Abigail Young. Now, Abigail Young is in prison, serving up to 20 years. She is now up for parole, which is a absolute travesty, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Abigail Young and how your son got together with her, and maybe some of the warning signs of what Abigail was like, but you just kind of wanted to ignore it because you didn't want to think your son was marrying anybody weird, let's face it. Why don't you talk about the beginning, if you will?
Well, actually, the beginning was quite normal. They were two young people, and they seemed to have a romantic connection. Abigail had a little girl by her prior marriage, and my son was quite taken with them as they were with him. And it seemed for all outer appearances to be quite a normal young person's romance that led them to get married. And we had no reason to believe that at that time or really any consequential time following that, that, you know, there was anything really, no warning signs. She seemed to be an efficient mom. She seemed to be taking care of things, you know, on a kind of regular basis. You know, she got them all fed and off to school and that sort of thing. But as the years went along, we started to notice that there were some anomalies and aberrations in her story, that there were things that she would do that we later found out she hadn't done, that there were bills that were never paid that she claimed had been paid, that, you know, the sense of accountability and responsibility for things just never seemed to fall into her lap. It was always somebody else's fault. It was always somebody else who was not doing their job, or their bookkeeping was sloppy, or she knows she had sent this payment in or that check in, and she can't be responsible for people who don't post it properly to her account and so forth. And that sort of, you know, we started just kind of nod and roll our eyes over that sort of thing because we saw the pattern of the irresponsibility, the fiscal irresponsibility as it played out. And the more that occurred, the more Ben worked, the more he tried to, you know, remedy the situation. And
excuse me, Laurie, can I stop you for a moment? Ben is your son, and a wonderful young man, and he saw this happening, and he kind of stepped in, and it was escalating. So Ben is your son. Please continue.
Yes. Well, he just, you know, like any good breadwinner, was trying to remedy the situation and just, you know, tap dance a little faster to try to get on top of the situation, but it just seemed to be escalating, and, you know, we did not want to interfere with what we saw as a family issue with, you know, with the communication deteriorating and so forth, so we just, you know, we didn't want to jeopardize our relationship with the grandchildren, and we didn't want to alienate anyone in the event that there would be a reconciliation and so forth, so, you know, the family just kind of stood on and just supported everyone as best we could. I continued to babysit for the children and continued to be available whenever, you know, they needed me because of their respective work situations and work schedules. And so, you know, we proceeded as though, you know, things were going to work out.
Exactly. But then you started to notice that Abigail Young was going to work a lot. I mean, a lot.
Well, she
but
had
the money
jobs.
The money wasn't coming in though, was it? She was a nurse.
She was a registered nurse, and she had one position at a local hospital, and she was doing sort of moonlighting, I guess you could say, for a friend who had started a private visiting nurse service, and that allowed her to get a little extra income on a schedule when I could babysit the children and so forth. And so we thought that, you know, perhaps they were on the road to you know, recovery, and they were going to try to make things work and so forth. And it really was only in hindsight, I have to admit, that we started to look back and say, gee, maybe that wasn't work-related. Gee, do you really think she was going to work all those times? So at the time, our suspicions were not really raised because of the circumstances, but it was in hindsight that we started to re-examine the situation, re-examine the frequency of things, and start to wonder.
So Abigail Young, who is married to your son Ben, and is all of a sudden telling everybody, I don't know, I paid that bill, I did that, it's their fault, never taking responsibility for anything, and it was always somebody else's fault. Your son, eventually, they divorced. And this is, if I understand correctly, this is where things started to get very strange. Can you pick up at the divorce and how it led up to you noticing things were not right?
Well, we sensed a strain, as I mentioned. The family was aware of tension and stress and strain, but we felt it was not our place to interfere. Mm-hmm. And it was in January of 2009, I believe, that our son came to us and said that Abigail had demanded a divorce. And he was very upset because we did not have divorce in the family. We had no history of divorce, and he felt as though that, you know, he had let everybody down and so forth. But, you know, we assured him that, you know, this was something beyond his control and that we would support him in any way that we could. And so from January through about, I want to say through about the end of February, beginning of March, he continued to live at the house in a separate bedroom, and just they basically lived their own lives, but independently of each other, just for the sake of the children and for the appearances of having both parents in the house. But her behavior allegedly became increasingly abusive. She more frequently took phone calls from Lucas Coe in front of Ben. They were obviously of a romantic nature, and
we need to stop. Can we stop right there? Lucas Coe is the man that was found guilty of sexually abusing your granddaughter Emma to death, basically, and he is now in prison with life without parole. So now we have Abigail taking calls in front of your son from her boyfriend. Oh, God. Okay.
And then,
please,
and then
please
leaving
continue.
The house, and there were occasions where she would leave the house to go meet him and not come home for hours. In fact, you know, it just became an untenable situation. So by the end of March, beginning of April, Ben realized that, you know, he really, you know, for his own sense of well-being, could not stay in the house any longer, and he returned home to our residence. At that point in time, the divorce proceedings began. She insisted, of course, on child support, and there were visitation periods that were established and so forth. You know, the
typical
divorce kind
sure.
of proceeding, you know, with separation and so forth. And it was heartbreaking. It was very difficult, you know, to have only access to seeing the grandchildren, him only seeing his children, you know, every other weekend and so
mm-hmm.
forth. And, you know, it was very disturbing because he had his suspicions that there was a romantic relationship going on, but he was never able to determine with any kind of solid evidence that there was anyone there at the house. Of course, you know, when he'd go to get the children, there was no one there, no truck, mm-hmm. no vehicle, no, you know, evidence of, you know, men's cologne or anything like that to indicate that anybody had been there. And, you know, he became rather aware of the fact that the children had been scripted. They had been told what to say and what not to say to Daddy when they were visiting with him. So the tension increased and the suspicion began to increase. And, you know, we just attributed it to the typical tension that goes along with, you know, the time preceding a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And we just told him that, you know, that he was upset and we were upset, but we couldn't let our emotions color our time with the children, and we needed to keep things as normal as we could. And so, you know, that's how we proceeded.
May I stop you right here, Laurie?
Yeah,
Laurie, can
ahead.
I stop you right here?
Certainly.
We're talking with Laurie Thompson. Her daughter, her granddaughter, Emma Thompson, was brutally murdered via sexual abuse by the boyfriend of Abigail Young, and we're getting into that story. Did at this time the divorce and, you know, your suspicions, was there any hint of anything that would make you think of abuse in any way?
Abigail was very careful to make sure that when we had the girls, there was no evidence of anything disruptive or out of the ordinary. I was never really aware of anything until around, I want to say about 2 weeks after Easter, when we had the children visiting and Emma had some old bruises on her cheek that were fading. And I said, "What happened? How did she get that bruise on her cheek?" And both her sisters and her dad told us, well, she fell. There was a wrought iron table on the patio, and they were playing, you know, the Easter egg hunt and running around, and she tripped and crashed into the wrought iron table. And it seemed to be the story that everybody had, and so we had really no reason to question it. And I said, I think I even asked Emma, I said, how did you get your boo-boo? And she said, I fell down, and even said something about a table. So I really had no reason to believe that it was anything but that accident. But that was really the only time that I was aware of something out of the ordinary on Emma. In fact, when we had Emma for the very last time, it was the weekend just prior. It would have been around the 20th, the 21st, whatever that Friday and Saturday was. We had her for the entire weekend, and my husband and I had taken her to our community pool. And, of course, like any little person, they have to go to the bathroom as soon as they get there. So the entire bathing suit had to come off to go to the bathroom.
Sure.
There was not a mark on that child. We were under fluorescent light and, you know, taking her to the potty like Grandma does. There was nothing on her, not a bruise, not a mark, nothing. She was smiling, and you know, we did what we needed to do. We put the bathing suit back on, and we went back out to the pool with Pop-Pop. So that was, you know, just a few days. We had her for that weekend, and a week later she was dead.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So it has been determined that this abuse had been going on for how long, did they say, before she was taken to the hospital and died?
Well, the autopsy results, and again, looking backwards, they think that the injuries she sustained occurred 12 to 24 hours prior to her death.
Mm-hmm.
She had been abused. She had been abused prior to that because in the early part of June, at the requirement of the CPS and at the requirement of the pediatrician who had noticed blisters on her, when they determined that she had contracted herpes.
Oh, my God. She contracted herpes?
Yes.
Oh, that poor angel. So, and this was, so in other words, okay, let me back up here, because whenever I hear the story, I get so rattled because I get so angry. And Andy Kahn will be coming to you in just a bit here. We're talking with Laurie Thompson. Her granddaughter, Emma Thompson, was sexually abused and died from that abuse. The man who abused her is in prison for life without parole. Her mother, the one that was supposed to protect her, did not, stood by and did nothing while this man abused her. So was there any time between the suspicion of abuse and her death to even call social services? Was social services ever brought in at any point to Abigail Young?
Yes. At one point, my son noticed bruising on her. This was after Easter, if I recall correctly, and he told Abigail that if she did not take Emma to the doctor, he would. And so she was in a bit of a stew, and she agreed to take Emma to the pediatrician. It later came out in the trial that Emma, I don't know if it was a question that the pediatrician asked her or if it was something Emma initiated on her own, but that in a very small voice, Emma said, "Mr. Luke holds me tight."
Oof.
And the that came out as part of the trial when the pediatrician was testifying. I did not know about that. But at no time was the doctor ever alone to examine or question Emma. And one of the things that I'd like to just pick up on is when Abigail was required by CPS to take her to a local children's hospital for further examination because of the herpes situation, she went dressed in her nurse's scrubs so that she would have a rapport with the staff as she walked to the door. She went at a time of day when she knew the nurse's shifts would be changing and they would be in a rush to wrap things up. Mm-hmm. She never allowed them to examine Emma without her being present, so they never, with them seeing a fellow nurse in attendance, their guard was already kind of let down anyway, so they didn't feel that there was anything really to be terribly wary of. They even in the trial testified that the usual protocol had not been followed in the examination of Emma. So she was very shrewd from day one in terms of planning and plotting and scheming and making sure that all bases were covered so that all suspicion was always diverted away from her. That was her modus operandi, was to blame others, find a scapegoat, find an excuse. Emma had contracted herpes from a toilet in daycare.
Oh, she. So, in other words, that she attracted herpes from a toilet. Please. Oh, that is so ridiculous. Now, let's back up just a little bit. We're talking with Laurie Thompson. Her daughter, her granddaughter, Emma, was brutally killed by someone who was sexually abusing her, and Emma's mother never protected her. What is the name of the scumbag that's in prison now? It's Coe. What's his first name?
Lucas Coe.
So, didn't at some point Protective Services come and say, are you seeing anybody? Oh, wait, let me back up. Lucas Coe was out on bond, wasn't he? Or he was getting ready to go to trial for what?
I believe there were charges pending against him for having sexually abused the son of a prior girlfriend.
So he's going to trial for sexual abuse. Abigail becomes aware of this because the social services person told her, right?
Well, I'm not sure if the social services had told her, but Lucas Coe's own mother had told her.
There you go.
Lucas Coe's mother had also told Abigail that he was not permitted to have unsupervised contact with his own 4-year-old daughter.
So
and
it was
to circumvent that, Abigail became the supervising adult so that he could have his own adult in the house with him.
So
this
in other words,
one big mess.
Yeah, this mother who has this monster child, this Lucas Coe, calls Abigail Young and says, don't let my son around young children. He can't be. And so she knows. And what does she do? She ratchets it up and hides it even more. How long was Lucas Coe with Abigail Young?
Well, again, we have to look backwards. We have to piece things together. But our best estimate is she met him sometime in the spring of 08
mm-hmm.
at a children's birthday party, allegedly.
Oh, boy, that's just creepy. Okay, so let's go, let's fast forward a bit. Your son is saying you've got to take her to the doctor. The poor kid has herpes, and she takes her daughter into the hospital for the other examination, but she's wearing her scrubs, so the nurses trust her. Nothing is done properly, basically. Now the day that Emma is, before she is taken to the hospital, tell us what happened.
Well, again, we're using a timeline that works its way backwards to the time mm-hmm. of death and so forth. There are some examiners, there are some ME's and some detectives who believe that Emma may have been dead prior to Abigail taking her out of the house. We
okay.
know from the autopsy reports that sometime in a time frame lasting 12 to 24 hours prior to her death, Emma sustained a fractured skull, a split lip, broken ribs, had 80 contusions over her body, and that probably sometime sooner than that had suffered some kind of blunt force trauma that severed her pancreas.
Severed her pancreas? Do you know how hard that child must have... Oh, my God. Oh, how awful. Now,
so at the time, on this particular Saturday... she had fallen, and we had about 3 different stories going into trial as to how Emma had fallen. One was that she had fallen backwards off a toilet. One was that she had fallen off a chair in the kitchen, and I'm not quite sure what the third one was anymore, but she had a laceration on the back of her skull, which was probably, and again, I'm not a physician, and I do not have the records in front of me to, you know, determine this for sure, but I'm connecting the laceration with the fractured skull.
Mm-hmm.
Abigail went out to the grocery store to buy super glue to super glue it shut. So she knew the laceration was already on the back of Emma's head. When she returned home, she proceeded to bathe Emma's body to make sure that, you know, she was trying to revive her perhaps or trying to freshen her up or try to wash away the evidence. I can't be sure. But in any event, at no point did she call 911. And she proceeded to carry Emma's body out to the car to drive her, presumably to the hospital, on her own. We have since, you know, the trial and so forth, learned that it was to give Lucas Coe time to get out of the house because he was not supposed to be there with his own daughter, and he was basically fleeing the scene. She called 911 about a mile away from the house, and when passersby tried to stop to administer CPR, she had Emma on the hood of her car. And said, "There's no point in trying. She's already gone."
Well, my brain is still frozen on the super glue, super gluing her own daughter's wound on the back of her head shut. and there were people on her car trying to help, and she said, don't bother. Oh, my God. And this woman is up for parole, and she's only served less than 2 years of her sentence.
Well, she was, while the ambulance was coming and while these people were working on Emma, she was also seen on her phone in the median.
Oh, of course.
Of the roadway.
Now's a good time to chat. So, in other words, she was probably calling Lucas Co. I think that would be
what the phone records seem to indicate.
Exactly. I'm sorry, Laurie. This is just so unbelievable. And I just want to tell our audience something. I've spoken with Laurie Thompson at length, Emma's grandmother, who we're speaking with right now. She's a very wonderful, strong, kind, and loving woman. And she is going to get into the injuries of her granddaughter. I think Laurie probably has to go to a place where she can just almost robotically recite it, because if she thinks about it too much, she has to protect herself. You know, she can't break down. And she's known about these injuries for years. So it's going to get rather graphic here in a little bit. And I just want to warn everybody, but Laurie is the voice for Emma, as is Andy Kahn. And I'm going to stop you here for a moment, Laurie, because I want to bring Andy Kahn in. Andy, you are the City of Houston, Texas Crime Victims Assistant Director. When did you become aware of this case, and how did you get together with Laurie Thompson?
Well, anytime anybody gets arrested for these types of horrific offenses, I like to do some background and research. And when I started looking at the criminal history of Lucas Co., I just was absolutely mortified, because I kept finding felony offenses for which he was on probation for. And then I went downtown and actually, you know, looked at the file, his whole history. I'm trying to recall off the top of my head, but he had several felony convictions. He was on probation for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and then he picked up another charge that Laurie briefly mentioned earlier on, another injury to a child charge in another county. So he's on probation already, so follow the bouncing ball.
Mm-hmm.
He's on probation, felony probation, for ag assault with a deadly weapon. He picks up another felony in another county, yet nothing was done to revoke his probation. That, to me, that's red flags spiraling to me.
Why wasn't anything done? Why, just slipped through the cracks, or was it because of different county?
Well,
why wasn't anything done?
Actually, in this particular case, he had at one time 4 motion to revoke his probations were brought before the court.
Mm-hmm.
All of them were summarily denied.
Why?
So
why? Why? Why would a judge deny that?
No one will answer that question. That's the proverbial,
Andy, tell me. Give me a reason. Give me something that would be logical why this monster would be allowed to continue out when he should have been revoked. What could be in a judge's mind, unless that judge was on mushrooms and LSD all at once with a bit of crack thrown in?
You know,
what would be on the judge's mind?
I can't speak. So it would be hard for me to, you know, try to figure out some sort of rational explanation. The only thing I could plausibly come up with, well, since they allowed him to bond out on the other charge, they must have not thought it was too serious. So hence, you know, we'll just go ahead and continue monitoring him on our probation. And it's problematic when you're dealing with dual counties that are essentially watchdogging a guy, so you don't have that control factor here as well. So that's, to me, the entire system failed Emma, from probation to Child Protective Services, you name it. Everybody had an opportunity to do something preventive and be proactive, but we all know what happened as a direct result. So that was my main involvement in the case. And then after the trials took place, and of course, Co is gone for life, and hopefully we'll never have to hear from him again. For some explicable reason, Abigail Young got 20 years, but she was not convicted of a first-degree felony.
Mm-hmm.
And that is vitally important, and that speaks volumes as to why we are where we are right now, trying to get legislation that we have now called Emma's Law. But because she was not convicted of a first-degree felony, she was eligible to rack up what's called good time credits. And under Texas statute, even though she got 20 years, she's eligible for parole after serving only 1/4 of that term. So you do the math, 1/4 of 20 is 5. you serve about 2 calendar years, and as long as you wake up every day and breathe and don't misbehave, you get what's called good time credits, which are generally 2-for-1 or 3-for-1, depending on what type of facility you're in. So you can see how quickly that can add up to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 years into her 20-year sentence, she was already up for parole. And I've spoken with Lori previously on other occasions involving the issues that were of concern to me, but of course this one just absolutely just scratching my eyes that this can't happen. But I also knew that the way the Texas statutes are, that Abigail Young, no matter what, assuming she's denied parole every time, she will be summarily reviewed every single year.
That's...
unless we get the statute changed. And you don't even get a year, and Lori will tell you about that. Basically, you'll be dealing with this process continuously within 8 months. Once you get it finished, about 8 months will go by, you'll get a letter in the mail saying she's being reviewed again. It is a nightmarish Groundhog Day movie. So that's where Lori and I talked, and I came up with an idea that, and I've done this before during my career as a victim advocate, anybody can yell and scream about the injustice of the world. I would much prefer to find a solution and or a remedy. And I knew that we could approach a legislator and see what we can do about enhancing the parole set-offs to include second and third degree injury to a child case.
So absolutely.
We approached, and I asked Lori, I said, here's how I like to do it. I want you to take the initiative on this. I want you to contact your local representative, because they're the ones who should get first dibs on this, where the constituents live. Tell her what's going on, the situation, and let's see if we can get her to sponsor a bill.
And that's where we stand today. Now we're going to roll back a little bit. I just wanted to bring you in, Andy Kahn, because you're such an important part of this story of helping get Emma's Law through and helping Laurie Thompson. So, Laurie, I want to take you back to this horrible day, and we discussed this before. I think it's important for everyone to hear because we can't turn it off, okay? We've got to hear the atrocities that this monster did. Because if we ignore it, that's what's the saying? The only way bad men get away with all of the things they do is because good men ignore it or good people ignore them. I totally butchered that saying.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
You know, we can't stand by it. We can't ignore it. We just can't say, oh, he's a bad man. Tell us about how when you found out she died, and then give us the progression of you found out she was arrested, that it was her boyfriend, and all the way up and through the trial, if you can, please.
Okay. Well, this, of course, all occurred on June 27th, and the evening of June 27th, and that happened to be a weekend in our family where we were celebrating the return of one of our sons from Iraq, and it happened to be his birthday, and his wedding was in about 3 weeks. And so he was visiting with his fiancée, and we had a house full of people, and we had dessert, the usual kinds of things. Later in the evening, we all went to bed, and around 2:30, 2:45 in the morning, I got up to get a drink of water, and all of the cell phones had been lined up on the kitchen counter, and one of them started to sort of dance around and vibrate, and the kitchen was dark, and I just didn't know whose phone it was, and I figured, well, 2:45, it's got to be the wrong number or somebody who misdialed from a bar, so I just let it go. We later found out it was somebody trying to reach us regarding what had happened to Emma. Around 7:20 that morning, our son took a phone call and he just could hardly stand up. He just collapsed. He said, it's Emma. And I said, all right, we don't know what it is about Emma. Let's just get in the car and go. And so we the house is about 30 minutes from our house. We got there to a phalanx of police and neighbors standing on the lawn, and of course they knew my car from the babysitting I'd always done, and so I literally came to a screeching halt, and Ben walked out and immediately was met by Abigail with this very sad tone. Oh, Ben, it's Emma, she's gone. And I said, well, we saw this coming, didn't we? And mm-hmm. the police all kind of, they were leaning on their cars, and they just all kind of stood up because that, they didn't know what I was talking about.
Right.
I had jumped to the conclusion that Emma had drowned because mm-hmm. they had an above-ground pool in the backyard, and it had been a bone of contention between me and Abigail to please take the ladder out of the pool. Somebody's mm-hmm. going to get into that pool that's 4 feet deep, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so my assumption was Emma had drowned. Right up until that moment, I still thought mm-hmm. there was an accident and Emma had drowned. And, you know, it wasn't until the morning started to play out that various members of our family were sat down and talked with and questioned by the police that we started to realize that there's more to this that's going on and that it all happened the night before and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But here again, I said, why didn't she call us? Why didn't you tell the police to call us? She said, I couldn't remember your phone number. But we were on speed dial with babysit.
Oh, brother. Oh, she is
so,
such
you know,
a
she was,
scumbag.
Well, when she came back from the hospital that night, the neighbors were all standing around to find out what had happened. And, you know, they were shocked at her demeanor, her cool aloofness, her detachment from the situation. One neighbor, when he was interviewed by the local newspaper, said it was as though she had lost a $5 bill.
Mm. Oh,
and
my
she
God.
She said, you can all come in and take a look around, but you might as well know I bleached the bathroom. You won't find anything.
What? She said that?
Yeah, she did. She did.
Oh, I can't. I'm sorry.
So
I'm not being very professional because I'm getting so upset at this animal, but please continue.
Well, you know, that was, you know, just really the beginning of the nightmare. And then, so that was Saturday night that we found this out from other people. And we actually found out a lot from the newspaper accounts.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Houston Chronicle does a very good job in some of their investigative reporting, and there are a couple of reporters at the Houston Chronicle that are really on the criminal court scene, on the child abuse scene, you know, very much wanting to get the information out. And we were very fortunate to have some good coverage in, and we were able to piece together a lot of the information from the coverage that was mm-hmm. Being determined by these reporters. So, you know, again, we were there on Sunday, and you know, we were trying to figure out, you know, how to proceed and so forth. And that's when CPS showed up and decisions were made regarding the children and them going with a family relative and so forth. And, you know, Abigail wanted Ben to stay at the house, and we said, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, this is, you know, he's going to stay at home with us. He needs to be surrounded by family right now and not here at the scene of a crime. And,
right.
And so forth. And, well, actually, I don't even know that I said scene of a crime, but just, you know, there's just too much sadness here, that kind
right.
of thing. And, you know, things just started to play out. They got a phone call. I don't remember the actual timeline, but either Sunday night or Monday morning, both Abigail and Ben got phone calls from the police to come down and answer some questions. Well, Ben went right away, and Abigail didn't want to go. And Ben said, well, I'm going. He said, I'm going. He said, I'm going right now. And she said, oh, well, then I guess maybe I will too.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was some questioning. There was lie detectors administered and so forth. And, of course, Ben passed everything. My understanding and my recollection is that she didn't quite do that well on hers twice.
Mm-hmm. Twice,
but,
okay.
In any event, things started to go downhill from that point. And, of course, we had to plan for Emma's funeral. And the family was in just a state of shock and numbness and disbelief. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just put one foot in front of the other. And you know, nobody was really thinking much at that time. So that's
like
so much of it is in hindsight, you know.
Right. You had to, you're right. You had to turn everything off or you would not be able to get up and function. So when did it start to come forward that Abigail Young was part of this horrific crime in the murder of her own daughter, Emma? How did that start to come into your sight, into your whole world? How did it start happening that you became aware of
that,
this monster?
It was that Sunday, of course, it was that Sunday, the 28th, when we became aware of the CPS involvement and the fact that they were concerned about the placement of the children. Her disregard and her lack of cooperation and her inability to want to cooperate with the police sort of set up flags with us right away mm-hmm. that she didn't want to go and answer questions and so forth. She continually tried to draw Ben back into the picture. She continually tried to blame other things. She tried to say that Emma must have had a diabetic episode because her sugar was over 400 when they got her into the emergency room, and she must have had diabetes and nobody knew. Well, of course, that was from the severed pancreas that we later figured out. But she, you know, was trying to imply that there were genetic markers or health issues that nobody knew about that had caused Emma's death. She was continuously trying to deflect and, you know, get people's attention going off in different directions, trying to confuse the facts and trying to sow seeds of doubt wherever she could. And so I guess really we started to really become suspicious, not only with the CPS involvement and the continuing investigation of the police. We, of course, knew about Lucas Coe at this point in time and that he had fled the scene. But then Abigail went and admitted herself to a mental health facility.
Oh, what, how convenient.
I think it was either Tuesday or Wednesday of that week. And, you know, so that all played out. And, you know, of course, we were still busy with the funeral plans and with trying to decide whether to go ahead with our family wedding, which Emma was supposed to be a little flower girl. And she was all excited about wearing her princess dress and her ballet slippers. And I wound up burying her in her flower girl dress and her princess slippers.
God.
So it was it was just a heartbreak on so many scenes, so many levels for everybody. And, you know, but we really, the criminal business didn't really start to kick in until we started to see the devious behavior and the trying to hide things. And
like what?
You know, she wanted to make sure everybody brought her medicine to the mental health facility. She didn't want any of her medicine left at the house. She needed that there. And, of course, you know, later on we figured out that she had medications there that she probably should not have had there. They were prescription, but we don't know, you know, in regard to, she claimed they were for weight loss and so forth. But, you know, not being a medical professional, I just thought it was kind of strange that she insisted on having all of that brought to the mental health facility. But I think it was at the instruction of her attorney to clean out as much as she could. But
yeah, get it all out. So, okay, so you start to find out. Let's kind of fast forward just a little bit here. Were you shocked when she was arrested, or were you warned that she was going to be arrested?
By the time she was arrested, we had been waiting.
So by that time, you knew. So what led up to you knowing? How did you finally come to the realization, my God, she knew about this, and this man was abusing, this beast was abusing our granddaughter? When did that moment happen?
Well, certainly by the time we had Emma's funeral, I had to be, the other grandmother asked me to take over the funeral plans. She did not want the publicity or the community
attention,
involvement.
Right.
Yeah, thank you, the attention. And so I certainly agreed to do that. And in dealing with the funeral home director, it came to my attention that they needed a sweater to cover her arms. And I said, she's got this little dress that I gave you. And they said, well, the autopsy was such that we need to have a little sweater to cover her arms. And I was able to figure out 2 + 2 that it wasn't the autopsy, that it was the bruising on her arms. And then I got a phone call later that afternoon that, and it was a very touching, very emotionally laden phone call from the funeral director. I've never, you know, for someone who deals with this business,
you would think they wouldn't get emotional at all.
Extremely emotional. Yeah,
right.
He was extremely emotional and very apologetic. And I finally just said to him, "We have to have a closed casket, don't we?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am."
Oh no.
And I said, "Okay." And so, you know, I didn't want to tell the family right away because I'm handling all of these arrangements, and that was just one more thing to upset everybody. But that was we had been putting the pieces together. We've got quite a number of degrees in our family, and by the time we put together all of that, you know, reasoning, we could come up with what was going on here. The judge had also told her that she could not attend the funeral, that if she attended the funeral, the other two children could not attend the funeral, so she did not come. But I think that was part of her being in the mental health facility, too, to give her a reason not to be there.
Right. So now she's arrested. Tell us what happens then, because this is, and Andy, I'm going to bring you in on this. This is where, I mean, if things weren't bad enough, this is kind of where it all becomes even worse, because now you have the nightmare of the court and going to court and listening and her not being convicted of a first-degree felony. I mean, all of this nightmare. So she's arrested. and the trial comes up. Tell us what's going on now.
Well, I believe she was arrested in August. This mm-hmm. occurred in June, and I believe she was arrested in August. And, of course, by that time, she's able to secure her bond and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the trial did not take place until the following summer, the summer of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And so in and amongst all of this is the CPS involvement, the family court involvement. The children have now been placed with me and my husband. They've been removed from the other maternal side of the family to be placed mm-hmm. with us. And so, you know, we're just trying to keep things as normal as we can for the children with school and activities and, you know, and of course they had their weekly counseling sessions and so forth and just trying to deal with the normal grief of having lost a sister.
Let me just add real quickly for everybody, and we're not going to go into this much, but the children are doing well. They're thriving. They're with the right people. They're in loving environments, and they're doing very well, thank goodness. So you're having to take care of the kids, and all of this is going on, and you're getting ready for the trial. And tell us about that horrific time in your lives.
Well, it was, you know, there was just no time for any of us to really grieve. We mm-hmm. really couldn't even put anything in perspective. It's a shock when adults lose a child in their family anyway, but to lose a child to violence like this and to have someone who was a member of your family or that you thought was a member of your family so intimately involved with the violence itself, mm-hmm. it was just, you know, you're just reeling from it and trying to maintain a sense of order on a day-to-day basis. You're trying to go to work. You're trying to take care of these grandchildren
right.
that have been placed with you and trying to keep things, you know, on an upbeat note for them and mm-hmm. at the same time protect them. You don't know whether the media is going to come hounding them or try to take mm-hmm. pictures of them. And so on top of that, we were dealing with CPS visits and a child advocate visits, and that was disrupting the family time on a weekly basis. And, mm-hmm. you know, Ben could not get a divorce. While this was all in the courts, you know, he had mm-hmm. to go, it was like $60,000 worth of legal expenses just to satisfy the requirements of the court in terms of deadlines and paperwork. And mm-hmm. she was not going to agree to a divorce or do relinquishing custody or anything else. And so that got dragged out, and the family law court could not make a decision until the criminal activity was settled.
Right. Oh, what a nightmare.
That was a whole year of limbo for all of us. And so in July of 2010, I believe it was, she went to trial.
She goes to trial, and now you have to sit there and listen. Now, had Lucas Coe, the man who actually did the sexual abuse, had he already been convicted at this time?
No, they decided to put her trial first, and his would follow.
Okay. So
that's
this is when you find... when you finally first hear about the injuries. And I want to bring Andy Kahn in. Andy, being a victim's advocate for Houston, Texas, when you have a family like this where they have to come into court and they have to hear about these horrific injuries, what in the world can you do? What do you do?
Well, basically, you try to sit with them and comfort them and recognize that you're speaking for those that can no longer speak for themselves. And like you've already alluded to in my 25-plus years of being involved in the criminal justice system, this was not, if the worst, the worst, no doubt about it, child abuse fatality case that I have ever seen or read about in this particular instance. And, of course, from our perspective, none of this should have ever happened.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that is so maddening, is that this guy was a walking red flag, and none of it should have ever happened.
He was a walking time bomb. He sent out signals and clues galore, and the system, like I said to earlier media reports, the entire system failed, Emma.
Absolutely. Okay, so Laurie Thompson, you're in court. What did this monster beast do? And let's keep in mind, we know, and I'll say it even though if you can't, I'm positive that this woman, Abigail Young, knew what was going on. I don't care what she says. She knew. Tell us what you saw.
Well, you know, I don't think with someone who is supposed to have the college education she had and the extensive technical nursing skill that she was proficient with, I don't think there was any way that she could have ignored the signs or mm-hmm. in any way pretended or denied that any of this was going on. I think she was simply looking to either pass the blame off to someone else or was hoping that something would happen when she was not at home or... And I'm sure that's what the portion of the sentence by omission means is that, you know, mm-hmm. by not doing something and choosing to ignore it, she was culpable in the course of the
Absolutely.
Event.
Absolutely.
I was not able to sit through the trial because I had the care of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to stay at home and make sure that they did not have access to the news or to any papers or any kind of contact that anyone might attempt here at the house or over the phone
mm-hmm.
or anything. So it was Emma's grandpa and dad who went to the trial.
And
the
what did he tell you?
The only day that I went
you?
To the trial was the sentencing. You know, it was extraordinarily exhausting for him. It was emotionally taxing for him. I don't know how he sat through every day of testimony from doctors and medical examiners, the autopsy report, the autopsy photos that were put up on big screens in the mm-hmm. courtroom. He just felt, and all he kept telling me was somebody has to be there for Emma. Somebody has to be there to let people know that Emma counted. And so, you know, this man was just stalwart in his devotion right up until the very end. But both he and Emma's dad asked me to be there on the day of the sentencing, and so
mm-hmm.
I did go to the courtroom for that.
What were the injuries that caused her death?
The official cause or the official, on the death certificate, the official cause of death is blunt force trauma to the abdomen. They don't know what weapon or weapons were used. They don't know if it was fists or feet or, you know, objects. As you alluded to earlier, the pancreas is quite high and deep inside the thoracic cavity, and so, you know, there had to be extensive source of force applied to her, whether it was, you know, stomping or kicking or fists or whatever was used. She had to have internal bleeding. She had vaginal bleeding. There was a laceration in her vagina. She had the fractured skull. She had the laceration to the back of her skull. You know, if you put your tongue between your upper lip and your teeth, there's a flap of skin that connects.
Mm-hmm.
That was torn away. That was almost completely dissolved. Broken ribs, I guess I mentioned that. And there were the imprints of Lucas Coe's fingers on her abdomen.
Oh, my God. So she's, well, okay, I do have a question. Somebody, and this is a great question. Andy, I'm going to give it to you. Why wasn't she convicted or charged with a first-degree crime? How did she get something so minuscule when you can compare it to the actual crime itself?
Well, it's just another classic example of how the actual offense doesn't truly depict what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just difficult when you're trying to get 12 people to agree on anything in this day and age.
So was she charged with something more, but they were given this option? What happened?
Lori,
yes.
Do you recall specifically? Yeah. Jury had
she
options,
was,
if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did have options. I believe it had a lot to do with the instructions that the judge gave to the jury in their consideration. She was originally charged with serious bodily injury to a child under the age of 6,
mm-hmm.
and she was convicted of reckless bodily injury
reckless
to a child under
injury,
the age of
right.
By omission. And I think the best I could figure out from talking with the DA was the instructions that had been given to the jury was that in order for her to be convicted of the first-degree felony, this more serious charge, she would have had to have been physically present and observing Lucas Coe as he administered his abuse to Emma.
Oh, that's just
wrong.
It was
something that specific. It was something quite specific.
Okay, so now Abigail Young is convicted. She is sentenced to 20 years behind bars. We heard Andy Cohen earlier tell us that this beast, because of the good behavior and all of that, will be up for parole basically every 8 months. So every 8 months, Laurie Thompson and her family will have to deal with this animal. And that's where we come in with a couple of things here. Andy, tell us about, you have a couple of bills here. The first one I want you to tell us about is Emma's Law that you've been working on.
This was a bill that both Lori and I agreed needed to have happened, and of course we named it after 4-year-old Emma, so hopefully if we can get this through, she'll be thought of in a much more positive light and leave a lasting legacy. Their state representative in the state of Texas, Debbie Riddle, had sponsored the bill. Lori and I and another family went up February 27th to Austin to testify. We were extremely well received by the committee. It passed know, obviously this, from our perspective, is a no-brainer. Pass the House committee has passed the House. That's where it is right now.
What is the law?
The law basically would give the parole board discretion when they deny someone's parole for both first degree, second degree, and third degree injury to child from anywhere from 1 to 5 years, just like in any other violent offense. In other words, right now the parole board is hamstrung. They have no choice when they deny Abigail Young parole but to review it every year because that's how the statutes read.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is give them more discretion for cases like Young so that if they're so inclined, which we hope they will be if we get this passed, that they won't have to review her every single year and put Lori and her family through this needless process every year or so. It's, you know, it's a waste of everybody's time, energy, resources, and money. I don't think they're going to ever parole her this quickly, but because of the way the statutes are, you have to deal with it. And if you don't deal with it, you open a door for them to release her.
So what
Where we stand with the bill right now.
Okay. Yes, okay.
It's passed the House. Mm-hmm. Now it's been sent over to the Senate. It's got to pass the Senate. Assuming if we can get it past the Senate, then there's no reason in the world that the governor shouldn't sign it. Time is short. In Texas, on May 29th, the last few days of May, the session is over. So between now and May, we have got to get this through the Senate, or else we're going to be back dealing with this every single year until the next session.
Is it retroactive? Can it affect?
Yes.
Okay, so it is retroactive. So now there's something of substance here for you, Laurie Thompson, and your family and your son and everybody who loved Emma. Retroactive meaning that Abigail will have to hopefully be put aside for, you know, 5 years the next time she comes up for parole. So the parole board will have an option to make it a much bigger space rather than 8 months.
Right.
And Andy, you have another bill that's very, very important and very groundbreaking. It tell us about that.
Well, what we found in the state of Texas, we had a death row inmate by the name of Preston Hughes who was executed in November, and we discovered several individuals had filed open records requests to gain access to the crime scene photos. He had murdered a 3-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl. Case was closed. They legally obtained the information, and they summarily plastered the photos of a 3-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl who's semi-nude all over their websites. It was absolutely appalling. The pictures are quite graphic. They're in a various state of I don't even want to get into how they were. But we were just stunned, and of course we found out that it was legal for them to do this. There are no laws on the book preventing anyone from accessing graphic crime scene photos and doing what they please. And you can well imagine when you've got a 15-year-old girl who's nude from the waist up, where else those pictures also end up.
Exactly.
We started doing some research into the issue and stumbled across a similar scenario in the state of Georgia in the year 2010. A 24-year-old college graduate student by the name of Meredith Emerson was abducted, raped, and murdered while hiking in a Georgia park. The case got a lot of national attention. After the individual was arrested and convicted, Hustler magazine, of all entities, filed a Freedom of Information Act wanting access to Meredith's crime scene photos for their publication.
The people of Georgia...
Can't make this stuff up. Rod Serling couldn't have written a Twilight Zone episode.
Good
people
Lord.
Of Georgia were righteously appalled. Elected officials as well. They passed what's called the Meredith Emerson Privacy Act, which basically states that if one wants to view crime scene photos, they can at the jurisdiction that holds them. However, they cannot reproduce them unless they get a court order. I love the language. So we've got it. We have a bill that we had sponsored by State Senator Rodney Ellis. Very similar language. There's built-in exceptions for legitimate media research. Victims' family can also give option if someone wants to have them as well. And you wouldn't believe the roller coaster ride that I have been on trying
really?
To get this to being fraud. Last week, in my illustrious career, I've dealt with many, many enemies and various entities, but I never dreamed I would be on numerous conference calls with attorneys representing the Motion Picture Association of America.
Oh, my God.
We were concerned that we would be eroding, you know, so-called First Amendment rights and access for their clients, which include Warner Brothers, Sony, Paramount, and other major movie production companies, from having access to true crime photos. And as I basically on various conference calls with their representatives stating, it is not, that's not our intent.
Right.
First of all, you guys in legitimate media, they don't plaster graphic crime scene photos.
Exactly.
For all the world to see. The problem that we've run into in this day and age with 24-hour computer access and, of course, internet websites, quite frankly, is John Q. Public who
mm-hmm.
gets a hold of them. And then they're at liberty, without any discretion, to do as they please with them. I said, here's an opportunity. It's not prolific right now. There are other states where I have seen graphic crime scene photos, and believe it or not, I have seen them for sale on other
mm-hmm.
sites, too. And it's absolutely horrific. I said, we all know that eventually there's going to be a so-called high-profile case where someone is going to get access to these pictures. They're
mm-hmm.
going to put them up, and everybody's going to scream and yell about doing something about it. But once in our life, we have an opportunity to be proactive
yeah.
instead of reactive and get ahead of the game and stop the inevitable from happening.
And that's
that,
we...
that will actually be heard tomorrow in the Texas Senate.
Oh, you've got to
if
at least
gets,
text
if
me.
If this gets out, it'll be a miracle.
If you've got to text me and let me know, because I know our listeners will want to know what happened, because that is a brilliant, brilliant bill. We have time for one question. Laurie, can you take a question? Is that okay?
It's from certainly.
It's from a wonderful listener, and this is Michael. Let me get to him. And Michael, you are on the air. Do you have a question?
I do. Thank you. This is the most riveting and horrifying story I've heard in a long time. My heart goes out to everyone. Ben,
thank you.
I just can't even imagine what you've all been through. In
thank
all
you,
this
Mike.
Talk about bills and legislation, is there any need for donations? Is there something we can do to help fund this or...
You know what? Here's the funny thing, Michael. There, people are going to think that this was planned, but it wasn't. I had no idea you were going to call and ask this question. There is, isn't there, Laurie? There is Emma's Fund. Thank you. You are such
yes.
a doll, Michael. Emma's Fund. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, right after Emma passed away, we wanted to think of something that we could do to create a positive legacy for her in her name so that she wouldn't only be remembered as the victim of this heinous crime, and we have so many hospitals in the Houston area and so many things that are going on in the medical center here in Houston that we decided rather than choose one out of so many that we should probably just kind of play King Solomon and go elsewhere. And so we went to St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and we set up a memorial account in Emma's name. St. Jude's Hospital, of course, does not send a bill out to any of their patients. Everything is on a pure donation basis.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Thomas made sure of that when he established St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And so we put up a fund. It's called Emma's Memorial Fund. And if you would like to make a donation to benefit the children who need the services of St. Jude Children's Hospital, this would benefit them and their families in a way that would have a long-range ripple effect. And I think that the producers and the folks there at Tricia's show have the information for that
yes,
that they
do.
Can put up for you. It's got an account number. You can donate online with a credit card, or you could send in a check to St. Jude's directly. And, you know, it'll all go to a good source, a good purpose. But if you just put Emma Catherine Grace or Emma Thompson on your check memo, they'll be sure to put it in the account for that memorializes her name.
Thank you. And Michael, you are such an angel. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You
I will
for asking.
Yes, I will personally get that information to you, Michael, okay?
Well, you can count on a donation
I know.
From me for sure.
You are
oh,
such
okay.
a
Thank
sweetheart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Love
Michael.
You all.
Love to you. Bye-bye. He's such a great guy. He's a, one of our – I told him, I said, I'm so thrilled to have a one regular caller. I'm just delighted. So, and he's such a good guy. He's very generous. Okay.
Very nice.
We do have to wrap it up a little bit, but I want the one thing that we want to do for you, Andy Kahn and Laurie Thompson, is we want to help you keep this woman behind bars. So there is a letter writing campaign going on now. If you go to websleuth.com, scroll down and look for the CAPER forum, C-A-P-E-R, that Citizens Against Pedophiles Early Release. Go there. All the information is there. And we're, and when is the actual hearing, Laurie?
Well, the we don't have an actual date. It will be August of 2013, and the letters need to be in the hands of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles no later than May 30th. So they've given us a very short window of opportunity. Her parole began to be considered April 30th, and anyone wishing to write a letter opposing her eligibility for parole is encouraged to do so. And they, you know, I'm sure they'll accept letters after May 30th, but they wanted within that 30-day window for the you know, for the bulk of correspondence to reach them.
And Andy Kahn, victims specialist, you for the city of Houston in Texas, these letters do really help, correct? They're just not ignored. I mean, they really do make a difference.
No, the parole board's motto is parole should only be in the best interest of society, and this is a way for society to let the parole board know loud and clear that Abigail Young deserves to spend every 20 years behind bars.
Thank you. And Laurie Thompson, Emma was very fortunate to have you as a grandma. You are a wonderful person, and if there's anything we can do, we'll be there every 8 months for you, and we'll write those letters.
Oh, I'm so grateful.
And just know that I always tell people this, you have an army around the world, and they come to Web Sleuths, and they want to do something, and this is something we can do. And Andy Kahn, we're going to keep you in for the discussion about Jodi Arias here, but Andy, thank you for all you do. You are the City of Houston, Texas Crime Victims Assistant Director, and we're going to wait on House Bill 431, and keep our fingers crossed that it goes through. Laurie Thompson, thank you very, very much. Take care
now. Thank you. I appreciate your help. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, wow. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I don't even know. You know, that was another incredible, emotional story. Don't you think so, Kimster?
Oh, absolutely. I can't even, I have no words. I mean, you know, I have no words. I mean, animals treat their young better.
They do.
It's incredible.
They do. And I just want to let Andy Kahn know I've put you on hold, so, you know, you can start singing or dancing, whatever you want to do, but you will be listening. And we may go to you. We may have a question for you since you're an expert. Katie, cool lady, can you hang on just one moment? We're going to do the Web Sleuth Hot Cold case, and then we'll go right to you, okay?
I can.
Katie. Oh, you're such a doll. And my friend and colleague and executive producer who makes tons of money off this show, what can I say? Kimster, do you have the Web Sleuth Hot Cold case of the day, the week?
Yes, I do. First, I want to apologize to Jan that we didn't get to her question. She called in a little late there at the end.
I'm sorry.
We ran out of time, but I just want to let Jan know that we're really sorry, and please post that question at websleuth.com, and we'll get you an answer. Also, I was thinking, Tricia, I might start a new segment on the radio show called The Aliens Thread of the Week.
Oh, I love it. What do we do on that thread?
Well, this week, I would pick the 7-foot floating head thread.
I'm afraid to ask.
It's a lot of pun, and it will tickle your cranium, and you'll find it in the up-to-the-minute section on websleuth.com. After you read about some of these cases, you need something to just kind of feel like a human being again, and that's a good place to go.
Yes,
indeed. I'd also like to mention a brand new area on websleuth.com that started just this week. It is in the Resource Center, and it is called the International Cases area. It's an index area, and each thread pertains to one country. So if you want to look at cases in Australia, for example, you can go to that area and get on the Australian thread, and there's a brief headline of all the cases on websleuths.com, or we're still building it, will be all the cases, along with a link to where it's being discussed on websleuths.com. And all, it will be all countries except the USA. So this is our international area. It was named by our international moderator. Her name is Marley Wings. She lives in the Australia, the country of Australia, and we're really happy to have her. Also, a shout out to Ima Mays, our super moderator. She's the one that got all the threads started for us.
Yes,
so
wonderful
wanted
people
to mention that. So if you guys, any of you from the USA think this isn't for you, that's not true. If you see somebody posting from another country, please guide them over there and let them know they can find out about cases in their country very easily by going to that area. It's in the resource center.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and get started.
Go for it. Yes, the hot cold case. We are ready for it, Kimster. What is it this week?
Yes. Well, first of all, because it's Mother's Day, I haven't gotten a new one out for this next week. But last week, I didn't get a chance because we ran out of time in our 3 hours. So last week, I didn't get a chance to talk about last week's cold case. So I'm going to talk about last week's this week. And
okay.
then I'm, in a day or two, I'm going to put up a unidentified case. And then next week, we'll get back on track. So
sounds great.
I'm going to be talking about last week's cold case. And I'll tell you what. Tricia, last week's cold case is so cold that there were only 5 posts on that thread when I first introduced her a week ago today.
That's
the
cold.
It's really cold. The setting is 1989 in Brownwood, Texas. We had some friends from Texas on the show tonight, but this is in Brownwood, Texas, on a lonely rural road. 13-year-old Amanda Goodman, also known as Sissy, has been found shot in the head. The single gunshot was fatal. Sissy was a beautiful girl and her mother's only daughter. Her mother has been begging for answers for years. Why did someone kill her daughter, and why did they lay her daughter under a tree with her purse and notebook? And, Tricia, why did they place a paper cup under her head? Before they placed her head on the cup, her head prior to that was laying on her notebook. But then he or she took the notebook and then put the cup under there. And the killer turned her head so that the wound wasn't visible. Mm-hmm. Amanda was not sexually assaulted either. If Amanda's mom were on our show tonight, she might tell us how her little Sissy loved to play tennis and she loved to go barefoot. And though she was a very beautiful little girl, she was a tomboy. She also might tell us about how at each candlelight vigil they've had since Sissy's death, they've played the song Sissy's Song by Alan Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit more information available on websleuths.com, but not a lot. We need our sleuthers to see if they can find any more articles or clues to Amanda's murder and then brainstorm ideas on the thread. I'm going to leave her up there today and probably Monday and Tuesday, so please get there right away. If you want to help dig up clues and perhaps help the Texas Rangers find out who killed little Amanda Goodman, please go to www.websleuths.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of Amanda along with the link to her thread. But only if you're a member of websleuths.com can you help by posting, so please join today. And Tricia, how much is the Mother's Day special regarding joining websleuths.com?
Oh, we have made an incredible special just for Mother's Day only. It's absolutely free, as it is every waking moment of your life. It's, I can't even say it. Oh, my flipping heck, it is so free to join WebSleuths. Thank you so much, Kimster. I really appreciate all you do. You work so hard behind the scenes. And now,
thank you.
This is what, you know, I can't wait to talk to you, Katie Kulady, because I can only imagine what is going on. Katie Kulady, tell us, just start talking, give us something. What, she's more nuts than I ever thought, this Jodi Arias. So just go with the flow and tell us everything.
Well, I think I'm going to start with a little Mother's Day business, because it is Mother's Day. And I was fortunate to spend almost the entire day with one of Travis's sisters yesterday, And one of the many things that my family has in common with their family is, you know, we lost our mother very early in life too, and then, you know, lost our sibling to homicide. And my brother was there, and, you know, my brother has been going through some trouble, and, you know, he has schizophrenia, and he's, you know, during, a lot of people at Westwood know my brother's been in the hospital during this trial, and he's doing really, really well right now.
Oh, that's
good.
But
anyway, my brother, you know, to hear my sweet, sweet, innocent brother say to this girl, you know, we know exactly what you're going through because we've been through it ourselves, and we lost our sister too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so incredibly sweet. And so just now, my brother came over to pick up a gift that a West Luther had dropped off some time ago, but I just didn't have an opportunity to take it to the family yet because it was a very large picnic basket full of snacks. And I just didn't, you know, like, how am I going to take that into the courtroom? And
sure.
When am I going to get an opportunity? Give it to them. So I've been sort of hanging on to this, but it's so interesting to me that whenever that's happened and I've had something that somebody's given to me to give the family, it has come exactly at the right time. And here I heard yesterday about this young girl losing her mom as a teenager, and here it's Mother's Day and I don't have a mom and I'm not a mom, and, you know, what do I do on Mother's Day and that sort of thing. And today was the day that I was able to give her that basket.
Oh, that is so good.
Yeah, she just texted me, and I had picked up some flowers because I kind of make Mother's Day kind of a random act of kindness day for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just do things like that. But so I picked up some flowers, and I thought, I wonder who these are going to be for. And then they're over at my brother's house because her husband is doing some work at my brother's house. So, I mean, these people are, like, trying to make money while they're in town, you know.
Right.
So we've been trying to find work for them. So, anyway, that's what's going on. So he came over to pick this stuff up, and to bring to them, and I said, let's give her those flowers. So I said, you know, even though we don't have a mom, and neither of us has a mom, we still get to have a Mother's Day. And I gave her those flowers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's just a little heartwarming story of, you know, a glimpse into the Alexanders and what's going on with them. And I literally was with them for like 8 hours yesterday, and they're doing well. I mean, they are doing well. I think, you know, now that the verdict's come in and everything, I think there's a great degree of relaxation going on.
Exactly. So now that the jury is in and they came back with first degree, thank God. But what happened? I mean, first of all, Jodi Arias goes against everything her lawyers tell her, and she gives this ridiculous interview on TV that was just, it was insulting. It was so ridiculous. Well, and then all of a sudden, boom, court's canceled until Wednesday. What have you heard? Give us rumor. Give us, make something up. Help us understand what the hell happened. It's making me nuts.
Well, all I can tell you is what my, honestly, the rumors that are going around are nobody that I know that is in the know knows anything that has told me. So if that even sentence even made sense. But so that day, I'll just describe to you what happened that day, because there is a little bit of a drama embedded in that day. So, you know, it's the day after the verdict. We all come down at 1 o'clock. We come up, you know, my friends and I were ushered right into the victim room, which was kind of unusual. Like, the doors were locked. We, you know, every single time we go in the regular doors, everybody else does. But the guy that, he knows us, that manages that doorway, the bouncer, so to speak, he just directed us right to the victim room, which was strange because we never wait in there with the family. But maybe things have changed now. I don't know. So we're waiting in there with the family and just waiting and waiting and waiting. The victim advocate is in there. And then all of a sudden, the door opens and Juan Martinez brings Dr. Horn in there. So now he's in there, by the way, standing right next to me. And for like 20 minutes, I know everybody has like this huge crush on me. So like, he was right next to me. And I'm just like feeling like I don't even belong in the victim room anyway. So now I'm like right next to this witness. And the advocate was really quite stern, like, you cannot discuss the case. You've got a witness in here now. So, you know, there's a little small talk going on. Everybody was smiles. Chris Hughes and his wife were in there. And we're waiting. Finally, they say, you can come in. So we go in. Now we're seated in there. We have the first three rows. Normally, through the whole trial, it's been the first two rows. And now we've got the first three, which I think is going to be the way it's going to be from here on out. And so they then Tanisha turns around and says to Julie, who is one of the people I attend with, who is a very good friend of Travis, says to her, who's out there? Because there were still seats on the row. And Julie goes, Katie, who's Katie Wicks, Stacy, just these four people that we have hung out with. And she says, they're out there. She says, go get them. So now these people that have been waiting like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning to get public seats are now being ushered into the family section. So now they come in and sit down. Katie Wicks, Stacy, people have probably seen her on Doctors, Jews, Jury. She comes with her cousin, this young guy, and a girl, Angie. So now they're sitting in there. So we're waiting. And then the woman comes out who nobody likes, whose name is Janet. I'll just say it, because in the public section, she's been very difficult, and everybody complained about it, including the media. She sort of manages the public section. She comes out, and it was so bizarre, because she's just standing there staring at our three rows. And I thought for sure she's going to kick those four out. Like, you don't belong over here. She's very much about that. And so she's staring for, like, I'm not kidding, like 30 seconds. She's just standing there staring, and then she takes a breath and says, court has been canceled for today.
And that's it?
And then she said, for the family, and she announced the whole thing to our side, for the family, the attorneys will come out. It's been decided in chambers, and we'll explain it to you. Then she goes over to the other side and says the exact same thing, as if they didn't hear it. You know, they're right there.
Right.
She does the same announcement over to Jody's side. And, of course, it's her mom and, you know, Donovan and the grandma and all that are over there, and she does the same announcement there. And then the victim advocate stands up and sees Katie Wicks sitting there and is like, what are you doing here? Because she sort of missed that whole thing, how she had come in, and people associate Katie Wicks with the media. So
sure.
She says, what are you doing here? And Katie's like, well, Tanisha invited me. At this point, Tanisha is back in chambers. So she goes, well, Tanisha invited me. She goes, I don't care. And then she goes, well, somebody else says, no, Tanisha said, she goes, I don't care. You get out of here. You don't talk to the media. It was really, really intense.
Oh,
she
that's
sort of
rude.
It
Why
really
would she,
was.
That was. She didn't need to be that rude.
Yeah, she didn't understand. Well, what was really sort of humiliating about it was that the other side heard it, you know?
Right.
Jody's family heard that. So anyway, we just skedaddle out, and we are descended upon by the media. And she also said, do not talk to the media. Do not tell them anything. Well, really, the only thing we knew was court is canceled. It's rescheduled for next Wednesday at 10 a.m., and you got to split. That was really all we knew.
That was it, right.
But what happened was, because Katie was in there in this completely unusual way, people thought she did something, you know, that she was somehow involved with this problem.
With
so
whatever it is.
Yeah, because that was the only kind of, like, weird X factor that anybody could put their finger on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, Beth Karras is running up to me. This other reporter, I'm saying to these guys, let's get out of here. Let's get out of here, you know. And I'm just trying to get out of there. And I'm just saying to people, well, I can't tell you anything, but I didn't have anything to tell, but I couldn't even say that. You know, I was afraid to say anything about, like,
sure.
when the next report was, because we were so severely admonished before we walked out the door. So then, of course, the rumors were flying, and the whole thing came up about Jody being in the psych ward. And what I believe is, which isn't any insider information, it's just, I think, what everybody, common knowledge, is that Dr. Horn is not available till Wednesday. Jody could not appear on this, whatever day it was, a Thursday, she couldn't appear because she wigged out and went to a psych ward, and that the soonest they could get Dr. Horn back is Wednesday. So I think that's the length, you know, the reason for the length of the delay.
Mm-hmm. So has to do more with scheduling. No, that's just an idea. I mean, that's just kind of your feeling. Like you said, you don't have anything to base it on, but that would make sense. You know, I just thought that Jody Arias went nuts and started attacking a guard or something. I like my story better, but yours is probably more logical. In that
I like
he,
your story better,
you know,
too.
I know. I mean, yeah. That's a little bit more, you know, in that they had to, you know, taser and hold her down. And I mean, I just had all these wonderful visions flying through my head. But
people
I think
were saying that there was some sort of yelling between her and her attorneys the day of the verdict. That's been floating around.
Mm-hmm.
I did hear that from a pretty doggone credible source. That one,
really?
That there was big fight between her and her attorneys, and I suspect if there was, there likely was for her insisting on doing that interview. I mean, that's the last thing they would want her to do.
And
of
it
course,
was so
people
bad.
I know she's trying to fire them, they're trying to fire her, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there was probably a heated exchange with she and her attorneys that day, the day of the verdict. And she will turn on them in a hot minute. You know, the first thing she's going to do is appeal on ineffective counsel. So she's already starting that. She, by the way, does have another Twitter account now, and she did some tweet about something about the through all of this, I've had a lot of people advising me and now have discovered that the one I thought I could trust the most, I never could trust or something.
Oh, brother.
I'm sure, or whatever.
There's a question. There's a rumor around, maybe you've heard this, about Jody's family saying, I'm glad the jury didn't see that. Ollie, too, asked that question. Did you hear that at all? I've heard that, too, that the family, Jody's family said, I'm glad the jury didn't see that. Have you heard that at all?
I have heard that. I believe that's true, and I don't know what they're referring to. Mm-hmm. But I have heard that same rumor. I just don't know what they're referring to. I'm glad the jury didn't see whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, things are really, really dicey right now for them because, mm-hmm. you know, this whole trial has been about saving Jody Arias' life. Let's face it. Everybody knows that she's going to prison. But the entire mm-hmm. trial has been, is she going to get the death penalty or life in prison? That's really been the big question.
The thing,
and now
right.
it's the wire. They have to, this is the moment of truth where if they're going to save her life, a miracle has to happen now. So I'm sure they're freaking out right now.
Yeah, you're right. And I'm sure they are too. I know Jody absolutely did not expect that she would get murder in the first, as we all know, after what she said about no jury would convict me. Do you think Jody's mom is writing a book? I do. I think she is. What do you think, Katie Kalady?
I think she probably is too. And I know I've said it before, and I'm controversial and unpopular in this, but I am constantly not landing on an opinion about her. I don't know. I think she probably is writing a book, the jury's out for me on her. I'm just going to say that she is easily writing a book about raising a freaking demon. She could be writing that book.
How to raise the demon seed. Have you heard that about how she went to the National Enquirer? Mike Walker, I guess, was on a talk show, and he's one of the editors there, and said that mom tried to sell those ridiculous false letters that we all know are false to the Enquirer to print them. Have you heard that?
I have heard that.
Yeah, and that's according to, a pretty good source, the Enquirer. I mean, let's face it, they get a lot of heat for what they do, but they've come up with some pretty good stuff. And Mike Walker said that live on the air. I think it was on Nancy Grace's show, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, that to me is kind of a sleazy thing for a mom to do. But I don't know her situation or anything, so I'm not going to judge. But anyway, I do think she's writing a book, too. Now, the movie I just read is absolutely on its way. It's I think, being filmed right now. However, they did stop the filming, and they're changing the script since they have a verdict. You remember when they did the Scott Peterson movie, they didn't have a verdict at that time. But now that they have a verdict in this case, they're going to have the movie reflect the verdict. So,
awesome.
And who knows? Yeah, so who knows what else it's going to reflect, but it is already underway. It's going to be on Shock Lifetime, and probably during the fall sweeps is when it will be on. Katie, I'm hoping, I'm going to call Chris and Sky and see if maybe they can both come on next Sunday, which I think would be great. How are they doing?
I think they're doing well. I mean, mm-hmm. they're really rock solid people, those two. And
yes,
that whole Hughes family, I mean, they're really an extraordinary family. And I just haven't been able to reach them today. You know, I was reaching out to them to be on. But Chris did say something to me that he wanted to kind of do a postscript from that really amazing show that he did last week.
last week.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say what it is, but he just thought about it later and said, I feel like I left people with, like, maybe a wrong impression about something, and he wanted to come back and clarify it.
Right.
So he will be back.
Well, he's always. He's always welcome. And like I said, we've got to get his wife, Skye, on here because she's our hero, man. We love her.
I talked to her about that. I did talk to her about that. And she said, you know, he's the whatever talker or orator or something like that in the family. Like she like sort of expressed like she doesn't feel as confident about her speaking skills. And I said, listen, you know, people just want to hear anything you have to say. So
I mean, she could get on.
Maybe I can tell her a little bit.
She'd get on there and burp the national anthem. We'd be like, yay, Sky, go for it. I mean, she is that cool. She is that cool. So anyway.
I have something to say.
Please, go for it.
I do have something to say about Jodi's wacky interview, which the first thing off the top is, of course, we cannot believe anything she says or take any, because it's a clip. I mean, sociopaths are constantly flipping reality. So, I mean, she's going to say one thing that 1 minute and contradict herself the next minute because her reality is constantly changing depending on what she wants. It's all about what she wants. But one of the things that I just found kind of ridiculous is this business about, like, she wants her death sooner than later because that's her ultimate freedom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Of course she's smart. Of course she has researched this. Of course she knows what's coming. Of course she knows she will not be executed for decades. I mean, she will not be executed for 20 years. We're in our 23rd year of appeals. She knows this. So in her, like, twisted up mind, like, if she wanted her death sooner than later, she really could cause that. You know,
yeah.
She could make that. She could have made that happen at many stages along the way. But somebody would interview her and that, like, ask her that question, like, well, how does that even make sense? Because you're going to be alive for a long time on death row.
Yes, you're not getting deaf immediately. Exactly.
Exactly. In no way, shape, or form. I mean, she could die on life without parole quicker than on death row. She just simply is trying to manipulate to get out of that situation because
that
is going to be nightmare for her on death row, which is the reason I personally want to see her get it.
Yes, and I agree. I absolutely agree. I'm not a big fan of the death penalty, but this is what the death penalty was made for, our hideous beast like Jodi Arias. So, okay, let's see. We have a question here. Let's see. Did the family, Jodi's family and Travis's family, did they hear all the cheering and everything outside the courtroom when the verdict was read?
No, you couldn't hear a thing. You couldn't hear anything in the courtroom from when that verdict was read. But I feel certain they've seen it on TV, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
But they did see, because they walked across the, there's two ways to get out of that courthouse. One is the entrance, the quickest entrance is right there where you saw those crowds. That's the main entrance that people go in and out of. But Juan Martinez's office is in an adjacent building, and there's a skywalk that goes across. So we've been kind of using that. You can kind of sneak out a side entrance that way, and that, you know, the cameras typically aren't around that side. It's just another entrance to that main courthouse complex. So we walked across that skywalk and looked down. I actually took some pictures. I'll put them on Westloop of that whole scene from the skywalk when we left because we didn't want to descend into that whole situation.
Right.
And I heard that the family did that too, and they did stop as they were walking across that skywalk and looked down, and they saw all that was going on out there. So I do know that.
Oh, good. Katie Kool-Lady, we actually had a guest on, and he is still on with us. His name is Andy Kahn. He's the City of Houston's Crime Victims Assistant Director. And I'm just going to go to him right now and see if Andy has a question, because he's also a follower of this case. Andy Kahn, are you with us?
Absolutely.
Andy, do you have a question for Katie Kool-Lady? She is the expert on the case.
Well, I guess the big question is right now is what's going to be happening with all her artwork and anything other personalized items that she has out for sale.
Do you know anything about that, Katie?
I don't know, but I do know that a civil suit is being filed. You know, wrongful death suit is being filed, so she's never going to make a dime off of anything herself. I don't know. I really don't know about all that murderabilia. I do know that I have posted this now that Beth Karras did a bunch of research. This is going off on a tangent, Andy. I'm sorry, but it is a little piece of data. She did a lot of research on her, people giving donations to her in jail, and she did get quite a bit. She got over $2,000 of donations, which is quite a bit for someone in that system. And then when I mentioned that to the victim advocate, she said, well, good, because that'll immediately be transferred to the family after she's sentenced. Yeah, so I don't know if those people donating to her realize that. I mean, I'm sure that they would assume that it goes with her, but it did not. If there's restitution ordered, which there surely will be, that will be considered her money, and that will be handed to the family.
That's good. So, well, fantastic.
No, I think she's going to. I'll tell you, I think she's going to be a rock star on the murderabilia circuit, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the state of Arizona handles now that she's finally been convicted, on how they handle anything that she produces or gets out there through third parties that are then monetarily benefit from this. I was so thrilled she was convicted. I had probably and ulterior reasons than most people, because I knew, due to her high notoriety, that this would be just the beginning of the merchandising and marketing of Jennifer Arias.
You're right, and it is going to be interesting to see. I think we might even see some new laws enacted, which you, Andy Kahn, know a lot about. So, Jody Arias is back in court on Wednesday, correct, Katie Cool Lady?
Yeah, back in court on Wednesday, and that's when the aggravation hearing is going to be. And that, in some ways, is going to be really the toughest. You know, it's hard to imagine anything's going to be any tougher for the family, but that entire hearing, the theme of that is to prove the suffering of the victim of Travis. And they have to break it all down, and that's why Dr. Horn is going.
His family's not going to be there, right, though? Isn't the family going
to be there? That's what we were lined up to be last week. We were all lined up to be there. They're ready for it. I mean, all the pictures are going to come up. I mean, they are going to break this down and say, you know, there's going to be things that are said about how he was alive and looking in a mirror at somebody stabbing him in the back and able to see what was happening to him. All that stuff is going to be illustrated for the jury, who's probably going to deliberate for about 30 seconds on, yes, this does fit the definition of cruelty, and then they'll come back and say, yes, and now we've got the death penalty on the table. And then it's going to go to the mitigation phase, which is going to be really interesting to see who speaks for Jody, including Jody. I can't imagine she would ever, ever pass up an opportunity to speak, but what on earth she's going to say.
Who knows? You know, oh boy, that's just going to, all of this is going to be very, very emotional. Katie Cool Lady, I can't thank you enough for coming on this show every week, making time for us. It's so special and great that we have an inside into this horrific case. We feel like Travis is somebody that we know very, very well, and that's thanks to you and Chris and everybody else who's agreed to come on the show. So, Katie Cool Lady, you do great work, and thank you very much. You'll be here next Sunday, right?
I'll be here next Sunday. I'll be in court this week as much as I can.
Okay, and don't just come on back to Web Sleuths, and be sure and update us whenever you can. And I'd like to thank again Laurie Thompson and Andy Kahn talking about the Emma Thompson case, Abigail Young. You need to go to our CAPER forum, that's CAPER, to make sure to write a letter to the Texas Parole Board to keep Abigail Young behind bars for what she failed to do to protect her daughter. Katie Cool Lady and Kim Sir and everybody in the chat room, thank you so much. This is Trisha's True Crime Radio. Now, do remember this, everybody. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests. I take no responsibility for them. Trisha's True Crime Radio is completely separate from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you have a problem with the radio show, you come to me, not to the forums. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.